Coming up on Digital Music Trends 191 on the 9th of July 2014, we chat about US music sales in the first half of 2014, MCN's and Rightster's acquisition of Base 79, Ariana Grande's campaign, Taylor Swift's editorial, Samsung pushing on Milk, Rap Genius reaching deals with all major publishers, and much more. Hello everyone and welcome to Digital Music Trends. I'm Andrea Leonelli and this is the weekly show where we talk about and try to make sense of the latest news in the digital music industry. And DMT is available as an audio and a video show on a variety of channels including the iTunes Store, most podcatching apps including Downcast, YouTube, SoundCloud, Mixcloud and many more. And if you'd like to receive the weekly mail out of DMT, you can find that on bit.ly/DMTlist. You can subscribe and you'll get a weekly email with everything that's been going on the DMT channel for that given week. And this week it's a real pleasure to welcome to the show two great guests. And first up, it's fantastic to have Theda Sandiford on the show, VP of Digital Marketing at Republic Records. So hi Theda, and thanks for joining us.
Thank you for inviting me back. I feel like I only get to see you during South By, so it's nice to be able to see you today.
Exactly, yeah. And you're in New York, and I'm enjoying a quiet drink here in London, so it's all good. And I'm actually really excited to also welcome to the show Dave Haynes, the head of business development at Makeshift.io. And previously, many listeners will know him as the previous VP of business development at SoundCloud. So hi, Dave, and thanks for joining us. How's it going?
Hey, very good. Yeah, good to be back on.
Absolutely.
Yeah, it feels like I used to be a regular listener of the show, and maybe I don't have to listen to it as often or
exactly.
Keep up with the music news as often. So, it's been really good to have a good excuse to do that again.
And it's going to be exciting to hear your perspective, actually, because, you know, as somebody that used to be completely immersed in this world and now I can actually take a bit of an outside perspective, it's going to be great
to
hear.
Exactly.
To hear your
thoughts. I was thinking about that as I was chewing through that week's music news. I still read the news, and I get Darren Hemmings' Digest every week and, you know, skim over Music Ally, but it felt like there was a time where I would consume every single piece of digital music news.
Exactly.
And then now it's, you realize, you know, that can be quite a bubble. So it's nice to be outside that bubble for looking in.
And we can fill you in on anything you might be missing.
Oh yeah, I'm sure. I'm sure we can. And actually, it's going to be quite a fun show because it's a fairly light news week, so we actually get to chat a little bit about what you both are up to as well, which is going to be fun.
And I managed to sidestep all the SoundCloud news, which is probably a good thing. So I don't say anything I shouldn't say.
Perfect. That was last week. So yeah, it's all good. And so first of all, I wanted to start by talking about the U.S. music sales. So Nielsen SoundScan released its usual mid-year report this week, which compares the first 6 months of 2014 with the same period in 2013. And so U.S. listeners streamed over 70 billion tracks online, a 42% increase on 2013. And these actually are split fairly evenly between the audio on-demand and the video on-demand spaces. So that was something that I found particularly interesting is the fact that growth in on-demand audio has been much greater than that of video on-demand. So video on demand grew 35% over 2013 this year, and audio on demand grew 50%. So, as a consequence, there actually isn't a huge gap between the number of streams made on one type of service to the other, which is surprising for me anyway. Digital track sales fell 13% year over year in 2014, with digital album sales declining 11.6% in the same period, and the CD market continues its decline. Unfortunately, the album sales lost 19.6% year on year in the first 6 months of 2014. Interestingly, though, both digital album sales and CD sales kind of declined. So, CD sales actually are still the most popular format for albums with 62.9 million sales. And so, you know, of course, and finally, vinyl is the one massively bright spot, although, you know, comparatively, sales are just 4 million units, which is not as much as of course, albums, the CD albums. And so even though, a few writers took these numbers to still look at this as being a doom and gloom situation, actually, there's been a general reaction reaction out there. People are not panicking. They're just taking these numbers as they are and trying to make the most of them. So as far as what your reactions are around these, what do you think they tell us about the changes in consumer habits in the U.S.? Theda, do you want to take this first?
Well, first of all, I'm going to say I'm not surprised by any of these numbers. This is how it's been trending over the last 2 years that I've been actually looking at it from what Republic's doing and in within the UMG universe, and then within the larger music business. Our focus has largely been the last year to drive streaming.
Yeah.
We're seeing consumption patterns of consumers changing, where their first screen is their mobile phone, and the streaming services are very apt to kind of feed into that funnel from your mobile phone, as opposed to the downloading, which is far more efficient on a desktop, especially if you have an iPhone. There's some complications with how you download and get that come back into your player. So the numbers aren't surprising. In fact, to me, I think they're somewhat encouraging because we're seeing very rapid proliferation and adoption of streaming services like Spotify. And some of the numbers that you're seeing, I mean, if we have this conversation again in 6 months, you're going to probably see a huge jump from January, really after some time in April, right. Because they changed their pricing model. So teens and college students are able to subscribe for $4.99 a month, and that's a very competitive price. And then with Apple buying Beats, when they figure that whole piece out and how they're going to integrate that into what they're doing, it's all making it very competitive. And the cream rises to the top, and the consumers are learning how to actually to use these services, and it's particularly ones that they're paying for.
Right.
You know, if you're paying $4.99 a month, 2 years ago, if you said, "Hey, I can get all the music I want for $10 a month," most consumers would be like, "What's the catch?" And I think now with the pricing being more upfront and bundle deals that are happening for family plans, people are realizing that it's actually really good value for the money.
Yeah. And Dave, it's funny because 18 months ago, everybody was running scared that, you know, worried that streaming was cannibalizing downloads, which, you know, inevitably ended up happening. So how do you see these new numbers, and how do you think that the industry will take to them?
Yeah, well, I mean, it's interesting reading the article. I have to say, with these types of articles, I tend to glaze over because there's so many numbers and so many percentages.
Right.
And it almost feels like, I mean, I think Mark Mulligan wrote that this was the 14th year of consecutive, like, decline. So it's not like this was unexpected. And like Theda said, you know, I think most people in the industry know this. And, you know, I think the big challenge has really been, especially for the last couple of years, is like how quickly can everyone like transition their business? Because the writing was on the wall, you know, there's a significant trend that's happening. And I think most, you know, the smart people are looking ahead of that curve. So yes, we know where it's going to go. We know where it's probably going to bottom out. And there's a lot of, you know, smart people doing the economics around that. I think one thing that I kind of worry about when I see these numbers is all the kind of the focus and the effort going into, I think the music industry is really always focused on it being a transactional business. So how many units have shipped and how many units have sold and things like that. And I'll come onto the streaming subscription in a minute, but I think there is a move now to more kind of ad supported services, you know, moves to other types of ways of monetizing, you know, the audience in the music industry. So I worry a little bit if people are too focused on these as the kind of leading key metrics, they might be missing other opportunities that are ahead of the curve and other revenues that can come in to actually substitute this. So I think, and again, I think it was in a Mark Mulligan piece, and he pointed out two very important things that, you know, the subscription side of it, you know, a $9.99 or, you know, whatever that kind of more premium price point is for the music subscription, that's always going to be a niche product. It's definitely got room to grow. And yes, there's like students who can take more of a mid price. There's a lot to be done around bundling and family prices and things like that. But I think ultimately we're going to need to see more like differentiated prices. So I would love to see a new wave of services that had a lower price point than $5.
Yeah.
And then it's just about how do you differentiate those and how do those not cannibalize the more expensive services.
Yeah.
But then lastly, just the advertising and ad supported services that can reach a much wider scale. And of course, as everyone knows, the challenge is, you know, what is your kind of average revenue per user? You know, if you can get more scale, you know, can you get enough revenue with it? So, I don't know. I think these articles are interesting, but it can be, I sometimes worry that people in the industry, you know, focus on the wrong metrics at times.
Yeah, sure. I mean, actually, you point out something that I was going to follow up with a question, which is talking about internet radio. So, of course, these numbers do not take into account anything, any data coming from the likes of Pandora and iHeartRadio. And, of course, Pandora, with 70-plus million unique listeners in the U.S. per month, makes up a pretty hefty portion of the digital consumption for the U.S. So, Theta, what do you think about that? And how do you think that these alternatives, means of consumption that are not transactional-based but pay-to-sound exchange, can be incorporated into the picture to figure out really what's going on?
Well, it's interesting. Just you know, the RIAA is here in the States is in a constant sort of tail chasing the dog with Pandora about the per track rates that they are paying to Sound Exchange, and so obviously the industry would like to have more. And Pandora claims that they can't do that because they're an ad-supported model and not able to monetize their service. So, you know, part of me feels like figure out how to monetize your service, especially with connected radio devices in cars. You can through the phone. There's a lot of different opportunities if they're smart to geo-target and be able to offer contextual advertising to actually make more revenue off their services. And I just haven't seen any of these ad-supported services successfully do that yet. Now, the new SoundCloud supposedly does do that, and I've seen some of the slides that describes how they plan on doing that, but it hasn't launched yet. So I kind of feel like my answer is I'm keen to see what it will be like and how well the services monetize the eyeballs and the ears that they actually have. And it's kind of on them to figure that out. We, on the other hand, you know, on the label side, are constantly trying to change what kind of metrics people are paying attention to by driving the most amount of streams. Driving that consumption and actually show how that correlates to other areas in the supply chain.
Right.
So it might be how a Spotify stream might impact YouTube or Vivo or vice versa, or how something we're doing that we're trying to engage audience and fans around user-generated content can actually tie back to actual streams that is monetized. So I say it's very early days. We're testing a lot of things. We're testing and failing, rejiggering it and pivoting pretty much every day. And I feel like a good 6 months from now, I could probably say, here's the playbook.
Right. It's great. And then it's going to change again.
Oh, yeah. So as soon as we figure it out, it changes.
Yeah. And Dave, what are your thoughts? You know, you travel to the U.S. quite a lot around internet radio and how those stats can be sort of integrated to give us a better picture of what's really going on in the digital consumption side of things.
Yeah. Well, I mean, just I guess just more of a general statement, I think, kind of responding to what Theo said there. I mean, there's a lot of smart people now thinking about this. And it's, I think, over the last couple of years, you know, she rightly pointed out, it's been a massive learning experience. And all of this is new, right? So it's everyone's having to transition. Everyone's having to learn at the same time. So I think we are getting into a phase now where things are, you know, a lot of the disruption, you know, happened over the last 4 years, and things are getting a bit more stable now. So you know, the smart people in the room can get together, no matter where they are, you know, whether it's a radio service, whether it's on demand, whether it's at the labels, and hopefully, I feel optimistic about the future, and I think there's a lot out there that, you know, there's a lot of value that we haven't captured yet. But everyone wants the same thing. Everyone wants to go out and figure it out. So
Absolutely. And sort of following on from talking about how to monetize audio, you know, streaming audio better, I wanted to shift gears and talk about MCN. So multi-channel networks sort of became the buzzword of sort of late 2012 to up to mid 2013, and everybody was talking about MCN. SCNs and the rise of these huge, you know, aggregators of content and channels on YouTube that could actually allow artists and other forms of content to monetize, you know, their videos better. And you know, this week it was announced that digital video distribution and monetization company Rightster has acquired multi-channel network Base 79 for around £50 million. Rightster is a public company and plans to issue 75 million new shares to raise £42 million that will pay, I guess, for the acquisition. And this creates the biggest MCN outside of the US, according to the company, and the fourth biggest in the US. So, you know, I wanted to ask you about your thoughts on the evolution of the MCN space in the last year and a half. Rightster is an interesting company because from the very beginning it set out to distribute and monetize video across multiple platforms and outlets, and not just YouTube. Whilst a lot of MCNs base essentially 99% of their business on YouTube, you know, what challenges do they face, and how do you see that space evolving over the next couple of years? I don't know if, who wants to take that one first. Anybody?
Oh, go on.
Go ahead.
You go ahead.
No, you go ahead, Dave.
Marvelous. For me, that space has been just like fascinating over the last couple of years. You know, the fact that there has been, you know, I think, you know, the MCNs would like to say that they've, you know, they diversify and they monetize video across many different platforms. But I think, you know, the reality is a lot of that business has come from YouTube. I think the one part that I've always been really interested in is how they've been doing a really interesting job for like this kind of long tail of creators, like these, right, these new people. Like I have a 5-year-old son and he watches, you know, these guys who are playing Minecraft and commentating on them. And they have millions of their audience is huge. You know, like he's not kind of sitting down and you know, watching traditional TV. He's on YouTube, and those people are completely new talent who are monetizing in a completely new way. So for me that was really interesting, and also a lot of lessons there, like for artists and for musicians to take out of that. Yeah. I guess for Base 79, because they've been around quite a long time. I think they were started in 2007. I think they focused, and because they were here in the UK, I think they focused more on like working with like brands that had premium content. So a lot of, you know, bigger media brands here in the UK, and people like Ministry of Sound and things like that. Yeah. But yeah, I mean, in the US, it feels like the MCN thing has been much bigger with, you know, the full screens and makers and people like that. So yeah, it's been a fascinating space. Absolutely. I think the sale price was 50 million, but only half of that was cash, and the other half was on performance. So it doesn't feel like it was a huge you know, exit for Base 79. It feels like it was more of a consolidation play. You know, two companies getting together, you know, to make what they do. I think we saw a lot of that consolidation, you know, with a lot of the indie aggregators and, you know, people like Orchard and IOTA. So I guess this is a similar time for the MCNs.
Yeah, absolutely. And of course, you know, even Rightster hadn't taken up, you know, a huge amount of funding yet. So, you know, its market cap is not huge. So this represents almost like a merger type of situation, in the sense that it's just such a huge acquisition for them. And but Theta, of course, for you working at Universal, I guess Vivo is the primary MCN in a sense. And how do you see that space sort of coming together?
Well, it's interesting because, you know, we put most of our videos through Vivo, and then they go onto the YouTube channels and in Universal Music Group, essentially all their labels and artists that are affiliated. In essence, that is its own MCN. But one of the trends I'm seeing is MCNs that are living on other types of video networks, like Vine in particular. Right. And that now is becoming a thing. In the last, I guess, 3 to 6 months, I have been approached by a number of different companies that are representing multiple Vine artists, as well as Instagram artists, and for short form video content.
Right.
And monetizing that. And I feel like, you know, I don't want to say the MCN ship has sailed, but that to me feels like 2 years ago, because a lot of partners have already been signed up, and a lot of newer different types of short form content that appeals to an even younger audience than the YouTube audience. There are these new MCNs coming up for Vine and Instagram.
Yeah,
I think it's very interesting.
That's fascinating. Yeah, as you mentioned, there's only a limited, relatively limited pool of talent out there, and there's some huge channels already, signed up to most of these MCNs, and so we'll see how that market develops and how it manages to find a way to expand. And actually, from this news, I wanted to take a little break from the news and stop for a chat. And so, Theda, you were mentioning some work you've been doing lately with Ariana Grande, and of course, I'd love for you to elaborate on sort of what's been going on in the last few weeks with her release and sort of how you've been setting that up.
Well, it's been a team effort. All hands on deck. From our radio press department, our video department, marketing teams, digital, everyone you could possibly think that could touch this girl's life. But we had a huge rollout last week with MTV globally. We took over the Times Square studio and brought back Total Ariana Live. And basically broke the internet. And one day we drove 1 billion Twitter impressions. Wow. On the hashtag Total Ariana Live. And, I thought we would be like maybe 500 million. I thought maybe 700. But when I went, I had to run the report twice just to make sure I wasn't making a mistake. And I was, holy crap, 1 billion impressions.
Wow.
In one day. So it really just goes to show you that if you have something new and exciting to share and the fans are just ravenous about it, using both television, online, fully integrated 360 type campaign, you can drive an amazing amount of awareness and discussion.
And so where all those channels that you mentioned, those outlets, were they all pointing to Twitter?
Well, Twitter was just one of the areas where we saw where we were trying to directing the conversation. She's very active on her Twitter.
Right.
We were running a campaign to offer people who were in Times Square, if there were billboards running in Times Square, so that if you tweeted certain hashtags, it would give you a preview of the song, so that if you couldn't get into the studio yourself, you can still have that experience through Twitter. So that was a pretty interesting integration. A lot of times on the digital side, we are really focused on, what we can do within our own platforms, right, online, mobile phone, tablets, and all our marketing is around those things. This was a real opportunity to work offline, online, broadcast,
everything,
social, and really bring everything together to drive a result. And because we had all those touch points covered, I mean, we broke the internet, or at least broke Twitter. She had three worldwide trends in one day, like last Wednesday.
Wow.
Which is pretty unheard of.
And it's, of course, it's awesome when it works, when it catches on, because you probably only get like two or three, releases a year that you can do that kind of coordinated effort on. So,
Listen, this is all earned media.
Yeah.
None of it was paid. So, oftentimes we're asked to, how do we, throw some fire or gasoline on that campaign and make it go further. We often, as digital marketers, think, well, let me put some money behind that. And it just goes to show you, just a little creativity and too many meetings and lots of emails trying to coordinate efforts and the timing and the rollout of things, that you actually can do something really, really big. And not have to, go buy SEM to actually support the campaign.
Absolutely. That's fantastic. And thanks so much for sharing that. And Dave, I want to ask about what you're up to now on makeshift.io. If people haven't heard about the company that are listening to the show right now from wherever they are in the world, what does it do?
Yeah, so I mean, Makeshift for me has been quite an interesting challenge, because it's taken me outside of the music industry, but going back to like the startup world. When I joined SoundCloud, we were only eight people, so this is kind of going back to that really early stage of trying to think about companies and internet products, and how do you get an MVP out, how do you test it, and then how do you build businesses out of those things. So it's quite exciting that Makeshift as a company, we've over the last 18 months, we've actually kind of built 12 like completely new internet products. shipped them, tested them, and like at the beginning of the year when I came in, we were down to 5, and, yeah. and now we're kind of in the mindset of trying to focus on building those into businesses. So for me, it's been really interesting, and like I said, not reading any of the digital music news to have to do that. So just thinking about lots of other things. But in the meantime, I keep getting drawn back into the music industry space and the music creator space. So I've also been in my spare time doing quite a bit of, you know, just advising and mentorship and stuff like that of other really interesting music startups that I'm seeing coming through. So it's been nice just to completely separate myself from you know, all of the everything going on in you know, with SoundCloud and in the kind of, you know, the broader digital music industry, and just really focus on some new things that are coming through.
That's great. And what's exciting you right now in the music tech space, if you look at the broader picture and sort of from somebody that doesn't have an interest in that space directly?
Yeah, well, I mean, I guess like most of the news focuses on, you know, the consumption services, yeah. and new recommendation services and things like that. And, you know, there's been a lot of stuff around like the live industry. But I think the area that interests me most is just, I think there's a wave of innovation that's yet to happen around like music creation. So anything through from, you know, kind of like new music instruments. There's a company right. called Roly, based down the road here in London, Dalston. Who have just raised actually quite a lot of money.
Yeah.
I forget how much. I think it was like $12 million, including investment from Universal Music itself, which I thought was really interesting. But they're essentially innovating new musical instruments. So they yeah. have a keyboard called the Seaboard Grand, and it's just redefining how people you know, play the keyboard, essentially. Yeah. So that's really interesting.
And I will get them on the show at some point. I meet them every about 4 or 5 weeks, but
yeah,
to record a show.
Yeah, they're really great guys as well. So I'm yeah. excited to see what comes from there. And then another company which I've been working a bit more closely with is called MixGenius, and they have a product called Lander, which helps this kind of long tail of musicians and artists to just very easily master their music. So yeah. if I'm a musician, I've just got a track out the studio, I just want to publish it, get it out there, or send it on to somebody, you know, without having to spend hundreds of pounds going into the mastering studio. I can just upload it to the web, get a version back instantly, A/B the tracks, and you know, then I can go and publish a much nicer version of my track. So yeah. Some really interesting things happening, I think.
Absolutely. And again, I need to get Lander on the show as well. I met those guys about 3 weeks ago and tried out the product and works really great.
Right.
And yeah. Great, awesome. So I wanted to follow up actually on this chat and what Theta was saying by talking about the Taylor Swift Wall Street Journal editorial piece that she published that has really made the round. Of course, it's Taylor Swift, one of the most popular artists in the world. And so if she does write a post about the future of the music industry, then people are going to repost it and pick it up from pretty much any outlet that writes about music. So she made some noise by you know, talking about her thoughts on how music sales are progressing. Of course, I don't want to summarize the post too much, but I know there might be some listeners that are at the gym or running around whilst listen to the show. And so she made like 4 points essentially. The first one, that music should not be free because music is valuable and rare and is a form of art. The second, that fans will keep buying albums if they're hit by the music, in her words, like an arrow through the heart. And third, that it's important to create unique moments all the time today, especially on the road. So you have to really focus on not just repeating the same set over and over again and bringing new people on tour and making interesting shifts, because people see so much stuff online already. And finally, she of course stressed that it's important to keep contact with fans, and you know, she's got over 40 million followers on Twitter, so she's definitely pretty good at that. And a lot has been said about this article. Of course, there are some things that are missed out. You know, there isn't much of a perspective around artists that are perhaps starting out or having a hard time monetizing the music. But as far as your thoughts are, once you read it, what do you make of it? And of course, it's a pretty positive take on the future of the music industry going forward. Theta?
I absolutely love Taylor Swift. And when I read the article, it wasn't like someone put those words in her mouth. That really is her.
Yeah.
And every point she makes, it's like she practiced what she preaches. Like, she's absolutely incredible with her fans. She shares intimate moments of her life. You know, if you're not already following her on Instagram, you should, because you're able to see it more so than just her talking about it. So I feel like she's dead on. And, you know, it's one of the things that it's one of the messages that I share with some of our other artists and managers about being authentic and sharing their truth and letting fans in on a big secret so that they feel an emotional connection. Music does a good job of selling everything else but itself. And the job of the artist is really to sell themselves. It's really the music almost is, for lack of a better term, almost a loss leader in a way, because people are buying in on the individual and the person. And Taylor really understands this. So when she interacts with her fans, from what you see, what she does from a live show or backstage, when she's meeting not just fans, but VIPs and other people, she makes every single individual person feel like she is there for them. And it is a rare gift. I wish more artists knew how to do that. And she does it in such a way that does not seem affected. It's really just, that's just who she is. So I wish more artists would kind of realize that it is not just about the song anymore, that it really is about the lifestyle and the connection that they make with their fans, that you can have an unsuccessful project, but one song may not get a ton of play at radio, but because your fans feel like they're along for the ride, they will support you in other ways.
Yeah, exactly.
So, she's extraordinary. And I sent that link to every single one of my artist managers this week.
Absolutely. I mean, that's the thing, you know, even though, of course, from where I was looking at it, I was thinking, of course, you know, this is an artist that is one of the most successful artists on the planet. And so it's hard. I was wondering whether it was possible for her.
Because of the tactics she's talking about is one of the reasons why she is the most successful artist.
Yeah.
She writes songs that connect to people emotionally. And when they share of that, oh, this song changed my life for this, she acknowledges that and feeds on that to share more of her own personal experience through her music. And, you know, not every artist does that successfully. She's found a way to do that where it's authentic, and it really is extraordinary.
Dave, what are your thoughts? Of course, an interesting publication as well, the Wall Street Journal. Not often we see these kind of editorials come up.
Yeah, I mean, I was pleasantly surprised reading the article. I thought it was a very positive piece. I think she used the words enthusiastic optimism, which I really like, because you can see, you know, with all the uncertainty and all the, you know, these changes and, you know, revenue in decline, you know, it's easy to switch to kind of, you know, half glass empty mode. I think we need more artists who are definitely in the kind of half glass full mode. So yeah, that was really good. I mean, there was you know, some kind of contentious stuff around, you know, the value of music, and I guess that can be quite a subjective thing. I thought what I really liked about it was it's just somebody from a slightly different generation. Like, a lot of these op-ed pieces we've seen have been from bigger, more established artists who have come from a slightly different generation and almost a different time, and are carrying a lot of the baggage of what the music industry used to be to reflect, you know, their views on what it currently is today. And I feel like Taylor Swift is probably in a good position to really have authority to talk about, you know, how it is today.
Yeah.
I guess especially for the bigger artists. You know, just some throwaway things. I thought it was quite interesting that she said, you don't really notice it, but, you know, no one asks for autographs anymore. They just want a selfie. That's a completely different thing. You know, the fan power. You know, she's part of a generation where, the artists get record deals because they've been able to grow an audience, not the other way around, which I think is a, From my point of view, that's probably a good thing as well. And she did that. There was also one point at the end there. She talked about genre distinction and how that was going away. So I thought it was a really kind of positive piece and quite good overall.
Nice, nice. And next, I wanted to talk about Samsung. So Samsung has kind of had a bit of a muddy approach to its music strategy over the last few months, just because of different partnerships and some services closing down and new partnerships springing up. But Milk is something that seems to be set to stay. So they announced Milk at South by Southwest, actually. And since then, they now said it's been downloaded 2 million times, the app. Of course, Milk is only available on Samsung devices in the US at the moment. It is powered by Slacker Radio. So essentially, it's a white label offering from Slacker to Samsung. And it's got an interesting interface, which is essentially a dial that allows you to browse through a selection of over 200 stations. So Samsung is pushing on Milk, and they just released a new advert, which is starring John Legend, Lady Antebellum, Chromeo, Iggy Azalea with Charlie XCX, Childish Gambino, Cold War Kids, and Little Dragon. So a star-studded commercial with also some interesting up-and-coming artists there. You know, it's just an interesting proposition, but I just don't understand what the tactic is here. In the US, since Slacker is not available anywhere else, and Samsung is a very international company, so they're going to have a hard time exporting the product. It's going to be hard for them to retain the customers that they already get that have Samsung phones, because of course there are other services out there that are more widely used, like Pandora. And also, they plan to start charging for this once you know the trial period essentially is over. And so it's going to be a ad-free, paid $4 a month, I think, from what I read a few months ago, a subscription, and it's going to be a free ad-supported play as well. So with all that said, you know, why do you think Samsung still wants to play a role in the internet radio space in the States? Can it catch on? Theta?
Honestly, 2 million downloads since this March?
Yeah.
That's not an awesome number. I wouldn't, if I'm Samsung, I'm not jumping up and down about that. Frankly, it's an app. Should be, if they want to be in the music, it should be completely embedded as part of the workflow of the phone itself. I think they have a long road to climb to compete against Pandora. And ultimately, you know, they're on an Android. They're on an Android device. When the new YouTube subscription service comes, or Google Play finally figures out how that's going to work, they're going to be competing against the operating software provider in the music space. So it's going to certainly be challenging for them. I mean, I think the reason why they want to be in the space is because they've seen how other telcos had bundled music to keep their, you know, to keep churn down so that people will actually not switch their phone service because it comes as part of their bundle.
Yeah.
And I think that's very attractive. But to have it be a standalone app within that you basically have to get from the Android store, I'm wondering how much real estate Android is going to be putting towards the new YouTube subscription service. So
yeah, you raised an excellent point there, because of course if you're Apple and you're not worried about, you know, customers are essentially wheeled into your ecosystem, you know, they can't leave. Whilst if you are Samsung as a manufacturer, essentially all the apps on the Android system are available on all Android phones, and so how can you differentiate yourself and ensure that when the new sexy Android phone comes along, users aren't all going to switch to another brand? And I guess offering an app that is only available on your device is one way of going about it. But Dave, do you think that's a wise move?
Yeah, I mean, it's kind of a tricky thing for Samsung, right? I mean, I do sometimes glaze over these pieces, because it feels like in the last 6 years you've just kind of seen this same story repeat itself
all over again. Yeah.
I remember, you know, there was days when I was working digital distribution, and we were always getting new deals coming through from you know, from Vodafone, or Nokia had a service, or it was like, you know, all the ISPs were trying to get into music because they realized they needed that part to, you know, reduce churn and all of these these kind of strategic reasons. And they would, you know, go and either license a white labeled service, or they would quietly buy a music service that, you know, like was struggling a little bit, and they would package it up, you know, do some exclusives, pay their advances to the labels, and then quietly 2 years later you'd read another article that said, oh, this music service is shut down.
Yeah.
So, I mean, don't get me wrong, I think everyone welcomes new music services and reaching new audiences. Like if they do have a group of users who, you know, they can you know, get into spending money on music, then that should be welcomed by everyone.
Yeah.
But yeah, I mean, it is difficult. I mean, look at what happened to Nokia. I mean, that wasn't the best story for a number of different reasons. I think Mark Mulligan again wrote a really great piece about how Samsung is now, you know, pretty much the leader, I think, in the smartphone business. But the smartphone business is quite tricky. It's not like the TV business where they put out good hardware, someone buys it at quite a high price, and it's quite stable. They just need to kind of, you know, innovate again on the hardware within, you know, 3 or 4 years. The smartphone business is people are replacing handsets 12 months. It's a very fashion-driven market. So the tricky thing for them is, like, how do they stop themselves just being a dumb device?
Yeah.
Because if this is just like a dumb device, you know, how are they competing against, you know, other players who have the devices but also have a content and services strategy?
Yeah.
And if you look at the other people in the space, you have the Apples, Googles, and Amazons, who are all in, you know, kind of, you know, doing their own device plays, but have also done more to nail their content and services strategies. So I think it's a tricky spot for them.
Absolutely.
You know, they're really going to need to execute on this and get it right, or change their strategy at some point.
Yeah, and you know, talking, I wanted to avoid, actually, this week I'm going to avoid it. I had it in the lineup, but I don't want to talk about it. I'm so sick of it. The YouTube controversy, it's been something that literally we almost opened with that every week in the last 6-7 weeks since it broke. So I'm going to sidestep that. There have been a few developments, but nothing that you can't catch up on next week's show, and I'm sure there'll be more developments then. And actually, there's nothing of note to talk about there. And I wanted to close the show, actually, by talking about RapGenius. So RapGenius has announced closing a deal with Warner Chappell, which means that the service now has a deal with all three major publishers, including UMPG and Sony ATV. The popular lyrics annotation service buried the hatchet with the NMPA just a few months ago, and is making progress towards properly licensing the content on the site. Of course, the RapGenius did need some good publicity after the resignation of one of his co-founders and one of his most visible spokespersons, who posted crass annotations on the Santa Barbara shooter manifesto on RapGenius itself. And so this is good news for the service. You know, gets them back on track, gets people talking about them, you know, in a positive light. And so, Dave, what do you make of the meteoric rise of RapGenius and its future, especially considering that now it is becoming a licensed service and actually seems to be heading towards the sustainable path at this point?
Yeah, I mean, RapGenius is a very interesting service. I'm not a big user of it myself, but
right.
I remember visiting their offices last year and they've had a lot of missteps, but the people that I met there all were like so passionate about what they were doing. Still scratching my head about how they managed to raise 15 million so early on from Andreessen Horowitz, but you know, at least they're now kind of, you know, presumably using that to, you know, make some deals.
Yeah.
So that, you know, this is a, you know, a business, you know, a business that can go forward, you know, in the right ways, hopefully. So I can imagine it was probably quite a fraught process, you know, dealing with the publishers, and
yeah.
I can imagine they were coming at it from a, you know, a completely different perspective to the publishers were coming at it. So, yeah, I'm quite pleased to hear that they've met each other in the middle, and I'd love to hear more about what Theta thinks.
Yeah, absolutely. And I feel like from your perspective, it's a very new medium, also as far as, you know, the engagement of fans is concerned, and we haven't seen many other sexy lyric sites come up like this that drive engagement. So how do you see this perhaps affecting the way that you promote artists, or the way that artists interact with their fan base directly?
I think it's pretty interesting because last year we did an informal survey amongst our interns, and RapGenius came back as their favorite place to learn about new music.
Mm.
And I I thought that was particularly interesting. And again, you know, our interns are probably they have their antennas up. They're very engaged around music. They want to work and have careers in music. So I thought it was particularly interesting that how they're using that as a discovery platform, because that's not really what I thought it was for. I thought it was, did I get this lyric right? Particularly, for some artists that don't enunciate, or they rap a little too fast, or I'm just not with the lingo. I just not really sure what is he really saying in that song. So I think it's particularly interesting how the service itself kind of grew off of that conversation of people. What are they really saying? And now that these publishing deals are done, it's like, okay, here are the lyrics. This is what it is. Where is the space for that conversation and the debate that made that site so sticky amongst people, kind of earning cred by being able to interpret the lyrics? So I'm wondering if this really changes the direction for Rap Genius, because the thing that made it great was everyone debating what the lyrics really were about.
I mean, I think that the issue with the licensing deals is the fact that they had the lyrics on the site, and essentially, you know, you just hovered on the parts that were highlighted, that had a comment on, to read the comment from the user or even from the artist directly. So I guess the problem that the publishers had and why the NMPA actually put them on the top of their infringers list was the fact that they didn't have the deals to actually display those lyrics on the site in the first place. So now that they do have those deals, I'm not sure how that's going to change the service. It might have to change the way they monetize it for sure. But
yeah, how they are going to monetize it is going to definitely have impact on what the service is.
Yeah, absolutely. And so, and that's always the question mark with lyric sites, because of course, you know, the licensing deals are not that cheap, and advertising is relatively cheap these days.
Yeah. But I mean, it felt to me, and again, not being close enough and not being kind of very deep in the Rap Genius community, I don't know this for a fact, but to me, it felt like, you know, this wasn't just, you know, a lyric site trying to do something and, you know, like optimizing it for SEO and getting traffic and just selling, like, you know, terrible advertising. And it's, you know, one of those, you know, nasty internet businesses that just sits there and, you know, creams money off Google AdWords. You know, it felt like this was genuinely, okay, this is a place where we want to build a community around the stories and the culture that is involved around these songs and these artists. And, you know, they would have, you know, when I was over in the offices, you know, they'd just had a couple of artists in and the artists themselves were engaged. And, you know, and for them, you know, if you're someone putting down those lyrics, or you're producing that music, like, that's really important. It's like, that's your thoughts, that's your song there. And like, to have the community kind of commenting on it and you to put that forward, I mean, it's a really valuable like piece of culture. So it's, that seems like a much different thing to, hey, I'm a lyric site, I'm using your you know, IP and I'm, you know, making money off it. So that's why I'm glad that they hopefully there's a deal that's been done that will also make sure it's sustainable and that, you know, that those costs aren't going to you know, reduce or kind of make it more of a commercial service, you know, so that you kind of lose the culture part.
Yeah. And of course, you know, worth pointing out that this is three major publishers. There are thousands of publishers in the United States that they need to get deal with to actually make sure that all the content is okay to be on the site. And, you know, one of the only ways to really do this in the US these days is really to go through a HFA or one of the other companies that can help you get those deals done. So we'll see whether they do that and how that whole conversation plays out eventually. And I think we've come to the end of the show. It was a relatively light show news, but it was absolutely a pleasure having you both on and hearing what you're up to. You know, once again, David's makeshift.io, right?
Yep.
Perfect. And Theta, for you, universalrepublic.com?
Republicrecords.com,
sorry. I knew I would get one wrong. That's perfect. Well,
it's all right.
Again, it was such a pleasure having you on, and thanks so much for your time.
Yeah, and Joe, can I just say, if there's any kind of like music startups or people in the world that I'm kind of in the mode of looking for people to help and have coffee with if they're in London, or make any connections. So if anyone wants to hit me up, then just reach out to me on Twitter and I'd love to chat.
That's perfect. And I've also got both your Twitter handles at the bottom of the screen, and they're going to be in the show notes so people can check those out. And thanks so much for listening to the show as well. DMT comes out every week. You can find it on digitalmusictrends.com. And of course, if you came across the show by chance on YouTube or on other channels, make sure you subscribe somewhere so you can keep up to date with what's going on, and you can keep receiving the shows week on week. Thanks so much for listening. Have a fantastic week, and until next time.